This week on Writers, Inc.
I struggled when I was first trying to write fiction. I've written a couple nonfiction books, watching, you know, Law and Order in the background late at night when the kids and my husband were in bed. But with fiction, I really struggled at first. And a lot of it for me was figuring out when I wrote best and how I wrote best. I discovered that even though I was a night owl, I wrote fiction best in the morning, which was kind of scary because it meant, okay, you're going to go to bed late, you're going to get up early. But that made a huge difference. And really, a lot of it is just finding that writer's cocktail, what works best for you.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, this is Christine Daigle.
Patrick O'Donnell.
J.P. Reinflesh.
Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. It's a bad day to be on TikTok if you live in Montana. You guys heard this?
I did.
So I have no idea how they're going to enforce something like this, but apparently the entire state of Montana just banned TikTok.
Yep.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that was a possibility. Like, I didn't know you could do that, like, unless you're maybe China.
But, yeah. I don't see how that's enforceable. I guess, well, no, I don't see how it's, they'd have, there's some pretty major things they're going to have to do from an IP level that would just flat out violate a lot of people's rights. So there's, I don't see how that's even possible.
The only thing I could see is if you worked for the state of Montana, if you had a work phone,
government, you know, they could offices, enforce the, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, yeah, no, this, good luck.
This one's everybody. It's not just the government employees.
And from what I read, the like fines go to the service that is allowing it to download, not the actual individual. So, I mean, it's dumb, but at least they're not attacking individual people because that would be worse.
Yeah. TikTok police, freeze.
So they'd have to block it at the IP level or something, right?
Yeah.
Huh. Lawsuit incoming, I believe. I'm not even a fan of TikTok, but I
love TikTok.
I just don't see this sticking.
VPN? Like, you know, I'm always in New York, even when I'm never in New York. So,
right?
No.
There was talk about individuals. I don't know if this was for Montana or not, but when they were talking about the nationwide ban, there was talk about individuals with the VPN getting fined personally because they're using a VPN. So,
yay. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. We can talk about that sometime. There's a push. Yeah, I don't want to get into it. It's very tinfoil hat.
Welcome to Politics, Inc.
it would get ugly real fast. So let's just move along.
Go USA, free speech. Yay.
Yeah.
I feel like Patrick's got that American flag behind him. You're going to have to start hiding that. You get a knock on the door. Make sure you can get that in a drawer real quick.
It's going to be bars and stripes.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, man. All right. Anything exciting going on with anybody before we start the news?
You know, I've been playing around on Substack. I just started a Substack, which has proven to be really interesting and a very good. I didn't know what Substack really was, I'll be honest with you, until I kind of had a whole conversation with Johnny Truant a couple weeks ago. And it's a my interpretation of it is it's sort of a blogging platform meets newsletter platform. I just started to test it out. I didn't need a newsletter platform, but it's actually gotten me quite a few subscriptions, and you know, I'm seeing a lot of engagement. So we'll see. I've only got two posts in, but I'm pretty impressed by it so far. So
now, are you paying anything for that, Kevin?
No, you don't pay a thing, and you can actually set your content to be monetized. I have mine set for free, and I'm thinking about the types of content I might monetize later. I've already had several people, because people can pledge without me even asking. They've pledged money and saying, like, I'll pay $80 a year if you monetize. So there are people who are saying they'd be willing to pay for some of that content. That's a good position to be in as a writer.
Yeah. Now I remember just enough about this to be not useful at all. So hopefully someone else will remember. But I remember there was something about Substack, about visibility, that it had to be monetized, because I remember looking into it a while ago. I don't know if anyone else remembers more about this.
Yeah, I don't. No. I don't know anything. But, you know, I'm brand new on it and just sort of starting to dig in. And if they have, like, that's a rule, then I'm breaking it right now. But I will say,
I don't think it was a rule. I just think it was like favoritism or something. But I can't remember enough about
it. I can totally see, because the only way they're making money is if I am monetizing. They get 10% of whatever I charge. But at two posts in, I'm not prepared to start trying to charge people for this. I think I would just sit in a lonely little corner for a while. But who knows? Maybe I'm missing out on millions of dollars. I don't know. We'll see in a few weeks. I'm looking to monetize in a few weeks.
So how does the monetary side work again? So you're posting right now, anybody can look at it, and if they decide to pay you for looking at it, they can. But
no,
it
would be a subscription kind of thing. So you can make posts either available for everyone outside of the paywall or put them behind the paywall. And then you can set what price you're willing to ask. Like, I could set it all the way down to like $1 if I want. I know it can set it below the minimum that they suggest. And then you have the option of offering like an annual rate, usually at a discount, and a founder's rate, which, you know, could be any amount above the annual rate. And that one, you know, it works a little bit like Patreon, where you can offer, you know, tiered options like, hey, if you do this, you pay this. If you pay annually, you get this. I have to figure out what those offers would be and whether I'm willing to put the time and energy into doing it regularly. But I'm enjoying the platform so far. I mean, it's lacking a few things format wise that I wish it had. But is in terms of engagement, like before I'd even posted content, I was already getting new subscribers, and you own the list, you own your mailing list. So, I imported my existing list in order to use that. And I've already gained like, you know, around 1,000 new subscribers just in two posts. So
cool.
Pretty good tool for writers. I haven't found a downside yet, so don't rush out to do it on Kevin's word. But I mean, I'm enjoying it, and I'm seeing some benefit from it.
Not to be a buzzkill, but did you read the terms of service?
Yeah, I read. I always read.
Who actually owns the content? Because I know Patreon, Wattpad, and sites like that, they actually own the content.
No, according to their terms of service, you own what you produce. It's entirely aimed at you. You can even export it, take it back to your blog if you want. You know, all that content belongs to you. Everything you're doing. It's effectively a newsletter service with a public face, is the way they've built it. Now, will it stay that way? I mean, it feels like early days to me for the service. I feel like it's still in development. There's still features that could be implemented, and who knows if it's doing really well. Amazon will probably buy it or something. That's a rumor, not truth. So don't quote me on that. But right now, everything is pretty geared towards writers. I mean, it's a very writer-centric platform in my take. You can also do podcasts and videos and things like that on that platform. So they're aiming at a content creation crowd.
Cool. All right, JP, what's in the news?
All right. KDP printing costs are going to change June 20th of this year. So KDP will be increasing pricing or printing fees for paperback and hardcover, and this will be effective June 20th. The claim is due to rising costs of materials, suppliers, labor, etc. New fee structure includes higher fixed costs for all books and an added fixed and per page cost for books with large trim sizes. So it will impact author royalties. So you may need to consider adjusting your list prices if you're self-pub. They'll eventually have a printing cost and royalty calculator in the next coming weeks. I've heard from a couple people that they've seen changes from as small as roughly 30 cent difference to a couple dollar difference, which is pretty big. something you definitely need to check.
There is something going on with Amazon. There are so many shenanigans happening that are Amazon-centric right now. I don't even know where to start, but this is just one more in the growing list.
I'm hoping this is just related, you know, like Bezos stepped down. He's got some, you know, somebody else is running the ship over there. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that this is just, you know, somebody new to the job that's just like, let's do this, and they're going to calm down. Like, I hope at some point. But there is a lot of weirdness going on.
I'm not surprised everything's going up. You can't buy a stick of butter before you need a small loan. I mean, it's crazy. So it's business.
You could go vegan.
How many of you actually check your... How many of you actually check your prices on these kind of things on a regular basis?
Not on a regular basis. I'm going to go in and check on this. And, you know, if your book is $9.99, you might have to put it up to $10.24 or something. It takes about 2 days for the change to happen. So, and, you know, been looking into it. Doesn't look like the pricing change will affect algorithms or anything. So that's good news. But yeah.
I gauge the market price, you know, not my cost on those things, because it doesn't do me any good if I'm aiming to try to make, you know, a specific amount of royalties each month. It won't do me any good if nobody's willing to buy the book because of the price. So I price my book according to how the market is treating mm-hmm. that genre. So as long as I'm not losing money, we're good. But I mean, you know, for years I only made like 30 cents per print book because I wanted to keep the price, you know, competitive, and you know, it may go back to that.
I set up reminders about a year ago, just to go through like Ingram Spark and KDP and like all the different sites, just to make sure that I'm still in the black. Because like Ingram doesn't really tell you, like you'll get an automated email sometimes, but like not all the time. A lot of times it can dip into the red and like they don't notify you right away. And if you're not looking at it, you know, you could end up selling it a bunch, you know, at the wrong price.
That's one of the reasons why I'm pretty, you know, we're still new. The DDD print thing is still pretty new, and it's definitely not the best run running out there for POD, but you know, one of the things I trust about the company, you know, just back me out of it as an author. One of the things I trust about it is they are always looking to see if something's going to hurt you. So if your pricing is too low and it's going to start costing you, you start getting messages about that, and we give the author the option to do it. I mean, some authors are like, yeah, fine, I'll pay, you know, 30 cents a book to sell or whatever. I don't know why you would do that, but if you want to do it, you can do it. But we alert you.
Yeah.
Free plug for DDD. I didn't mean it that way, but I'm just saying I like that feature, and Ingram should have that feature. And at least Amazon mm-hmm. is letting everyone know instead of just simply raising the costs.
But it is a good point to look at, you know, what's selling in your genre, because, you know, you might think, oh, $9.99 to $10.24 for the same royalties isn't a big deal. But there's a big psychological difference, you know, mm-hmm. for someone spending under $10 to over $10. So that is something to consider as well.
I started like years back, I started listing everything at 97 cents instead of 99, because most books are at 99. So if you're at 10.97 instead of 10.99, you know, you end up at the top of the list or a lot of lists just because of those couple of pennies.
Cool. Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting tactic. I'll have to experiment with it. Yeah. I'm going to do 83 cents.
83. I'll do 82.
$1. Okay.
Damn you, Parker.
Next up in the news. The Association of American Publishers met on May 8th, and they were just noting some of the publishing industry things that they're grappling with. So these challenges include the book bans, lack of diversity, climate change, copyright issues, and the implications of, get ready for those shots, AI. I think that this was just important to be aware of, that there is associations that are meeting and talking about these different topics. I didn't see a lot that came out of this as much as it is just people continue to talk about this. This is a continuous rising matter, all of these topics. And it's just something for us to be aware of, especially self-pub authors who may not necessarily be aware of these.
It's interesting to see what's evolving as the current sort of problems facing the industry. And some of these have been around for a long time, you know, and you don't often think of like, how does it relate, like climate change, for example. But, you know, there's a climate cost to producing mm-hmm. both paperbacks and ebooks. Like, you're not off the hook just because you go digital. I mean, there is a, you know, there's still energy costs. Energy has to come from somewhere. And a lot of our energy comes from things that can impact the environment. So, you know, these are questions that have been facing publishing in general for decades now. But it's also sort of coming to the head. And I, for me, it's interesting to note that I believe that AI is somehow a catalyst for making people more aware of some of these issues. Like it's somehow the discussion of AI has dredged up a whole lot of interesting things that we have just sort of swept under the rug for a very long time.
All right, last story. I found this story hilarious when I heard about it on TikTok, and then I talked with Christine and decided why not talk about it here. So the title is Bigolus Dickolus is More Powerful Than the Pulitzer Prize. So the sci-fi novella, This Is How You Lose the Time War, which was co-authored by Amal El-Motar and Max Gladstone, saw a huge surge after a tweet from the fan of the anime series Trigun, which was a user known as Bigolus Dickolus Wolfward, urged followers to buy the book. It rose to number 3 on Amazon's book list, even though this book has been out for several years. This just shows the influence of how like one tweet can just go viral and just wildly out of nowhere. This was a hilarious story to find, and I just wanted to add some levity into the news.
I don't want to live on this planet anymore.
It's just, it's so yes, mind blowing yes, to me, you know, and it was just like, you know, I think it was just that they had a big influence already in anime and just the it was genuine enthusiasm for this book. And I read this book when it came out 4 years ago. It was wild. I mm-hmm. really enjoyed it. Really fast paced, you know, enemies to lovers, violence, time travel. It's got everything. You know, and I met them all at a con, and she had great shoes. They were Fluvog, so that was a bonus. But I mean, it is a great book, but I can't believe it went to number 3. And just, you know, to be clear, this is a novella. So it's a very yeah. short book. So what happens after something like that? Like, you've been out 4 years, you've been selling decent, and then all of a sudden you're number 3.
What do we know about the person who actually sent the tweet? Like, do we know how many followers they have, or have any of you actually seen the tweet that
I
that
did
caused
see
all this?
The tweet? Yeah, I can find them and pull them up, but yeah, I know they're look yeah, yeah. I mean, they do have a lot of influence.
And the tweet
I know
itself
they're 22.
Was just right, and the tweet itself was just like, read this. Don't look anything up about it. Just read it. I think that kind of tweet, if you have enough influence behind it, can really just cause people to buy stuff. Yeah.
I would love to see the faces of the people at like the New York Times book review department, you know, like when this kind of thing happens, like do they yeah. just poke their head out of the glass door and be like, what the F just happened? Somebody
we
explain
need to
this.
Hire Bigolus Dickolus.
Does yeah. that yeah. become a metric? Like, all right, this book is looking pretty good. What's the Bigolus Dickolus score for this yeah. book? Is it, you know,
it
where is it coming?
Yeah. So Bigolus has 48.6K followers, so 48.6K followers. And actually, the New York Times did pick the story up and they ran it, but they just named him Bigolus, just first name.
Bigolus.
Cowards.
Lies and slander.
Cowards. Nah,
they're just on a first name basis. That's all. How long before this person is doing movie reviews and like actually getting paid for just reviewing stuff? Like, that's probably happening now. People are probably yeah. throwing money at him, like, you know, please pimp my book or my car or my this or my that.
Absolutely.
You know, like,
right.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Right.
Yeah. Cause nobody really understands why these things take off in the first place. They just chase them.
Yep. The power of social media, though. Kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that was a fun story. Awesome.
This episode is brought to you by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. AutoCrit takes you far above standard grammar checking or cookie-cutter guidance. Instead, it's like having an experienced editor in your genre watching over your shoulder to help you deliver great writing that keeps your audience trapped in the story. You can even compare your writing style to more than 100 best-selling authors right down to the word level, so you can see what the best in the business do to keep their storytelling clean, clear, and crisp. Listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can now take advantage of lifetime membership for one single fee. That's right, no renewal fees.
Hi, this is J.D. Barker. I've used AutoCrit for years, and not only has it improved my writing, but it's been a crucial tool with aspiring authors that I've mentored. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just beginning, it'll help you find your weak spots and weed them out. Give it a shot with your latest project. Trust me, your editor will thank you.
Head to AutoCrit.com/JD to get your lifetime membership. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
So, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Kate White. She's the former editor of Cosmo and the New York Times bestselling author of 9 psychological thrillers, including The Secrets You Keep. Her latest is called Between Two Strangers, and it releases May 16th. Here she is, Kate White.
So you have a new book, Between Two Strangers, a psychological thriller about a struggling artist who receives a life-changing inheritance from a man she spent one night with 12 years ago. And she has no idea why she's got this money.
It was kind of a fantasy of mine, actually. I'm thinking, wow, wouldn't that be cool? But I was intrigued with that. I actually had a weird thing happen when my mom died, where some of her money went to someone we didn't know who it was. And my brothers and I were really concerned and were sort of like, did our mother have somebody in her life that we didn't know about? But it turned out the bank had made an error. And so, but it got me thinking, well, you know, about inheritance. And what if somebody left you money that you didn't know who the person was? And in this case, this struggling artist named Skylar Moore gets left not just money, she gets left $3.5 million. And she is just kind of blown away. And the problem is, the guy's wife decides to come after it. And Skylar has to figure out what is the reason he left her this money. She never spoke to him again after their one night stand 12 years ago. And as it progresses, the stakes become higher and higher for her to find out why he did it.
Yeah, they sure do. And it's a great premise. I mean, it just sucks you in immediately, because who wouldn't love to be left mystery inheritance money? No. Anyone wants to leave me mystery inheritance money, please do.
Yeah. We can all hope, right, Christine? Okay.
So I have to ask, what would you do with $3.5 million?
Wow. I think that I would definitely up my bucket list of places to travel to, which is something so important to me. I'm here in Uruguay right now as we're talking, where I live in the winter with my husband, but travel is important. But also, and this might have actually affected me making Skylar a struggling artist, I love to collect art, and I would probably go after a few pieces that were out of my price range.
I love that. So yeah, so you're in Uruguay right now. And you love to travel. How does that influence your writing? Like, how does living in Uruguay, how does your travel find its way into your books?
Well, so far it really hasn't, but Uruguay is a great place for me to write. When I was in the magazine business, I ran Cosmopolitan for many years. I had a fantasy of being able to be my own boss. I think as so many writers, you're all about writers, you know, the big fantasy, you know, I'm not going to be talking to the man. And I had fabulous bosses when I ran Cosmo, but I wanted to be my own boss. So we bought this little place in Uruguay on the beach and decided that as soon as I left Cosmo, we would come down here and live. And I don't know why, but I write better in the heat. And the weird thing is, when I did a DNA test a number of years ago, even though I'm mostly kind of Scottish, Finnish, and Irish, and English descent, a little part of me came from Paraguay. So I'm thinking maybe in another life I lived here. And so I just find it a really tranquil, relaxing place to work. But my book, the one I'm going to do after the one I hand in, is going to have a little scene in Uruguay, finally. My agent took me into it.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I think, you know, I wonder if it's just a mood thing too, because I find I write better, you know, spring, summer. Winter, forget about it. Like, there are a couple months there when the writing is just hard. So I wonder if the sunshine and the weather are conducive to good writing.
Yeah, I think it's not just the heat, but it's the sun. What do you do then in the winter when you can't write? How do you?
I grumble. I do it anyways, but I'm not happy about it.
Yeah. You would think that, you know, in the summer we'd be sort of like, no, I want to be outside and play with the other kids. But I just love writing when it's hot.
Yeah. Same. And I think that is the dream. I bet a lot of writers, if they got $3.5 million, those of us with day jobs would be out and being our own boss somewhere warm. So yeah. I love that.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting as we're just talking about that. I struggled when I was first trying to write fiction. I'd written a couple nonfiction books, watching, you know, Law and Order in the background late at night when the kids and my husband were in bed. But with fiction, I really struggled at first. And a lot of it for me was figuring out when I wrote best and how I wrote best. And so it wasn't just heat. I discovered that even though I was a night owl, I wrote fiction best in the morning, which was kind of scary because it meant, okay, you're going to go to bed late, you're going to get up early. But that made a huge difference. And really, a lot of it is just finding that writer's cocktail, works best for you.
I might have to try that because I'm a night person too. So maybe I'll write better in the morning. Maybe I'll give it a shot.
It's worth experimenting for sure.
I love that. And you've written, 17 novels now? Is that somewhere around there, depending how you count them?
Yeah, 18 if I count the one that I'm just closing in on finishing for 2024.
Oh my goodness.
And then 4 or 5 nonfiction. But I have to say, if I had to choose, I would pick fiction so much because not only do I enjoy it most days, I mean, it's hard. It really is, as we all know, but it's also a great stress reliever for me. I find that I lose myself in my characters and the plot when other things are, you know, bothering me in some ways. So, you know, it's been great for me in that regard.
Nice. So I'm curious, the hardest part for me is always getting started on a new book, and you've been started on so many of them. What does your pre-novel sort of brainstorming process look like before you start a new book?
That's actually the easier part for me, landing the freaking plane at the end. When I almost use the F word.
That's all right. We don't mind. We're an adult podcast.
That is the hardest part. In the beginning, I love it. But the tricky thing for me, because as a thriller writer, I do a book a year, is that I need more than a year to do a book. I need about 3 months to work the plot out in my head. So what I'm generally doing is, as I'm finishing up one, I've got the other one going. And I've had a new agent for the last 4 or 5 years, and I had to have her understand this. I can't just, you know, get off the dime cold. I need to have had a few months to think about it. So what I usually do is when I'm in the shower, I start thinking about it. When I take walks, I do that what if game that you hear so many authors talk about, where maybe there'll be a little germ and I'll be, you know, what if this happened? What if that? And then I always know right before I start who the killer is, why they killed. And I also know how I'm going to try to hide that. So then I don't plot out the whole book, but I know those things. And then I plot out about 4 chapters at a time using a notebook. And the notebook also serves the purpose in those 3 months before I start writing of me writing questions to myself. And an incredible woman named Laura Day, who wrote a book on practical intuition, we interviewed her once when I was in the magazine business. And she said, when you don't have the answer to a creative question, put it out to the universe. Like, well, why would the person do that in this book? And I write those questions in the notebook, and it is really weird. It is spooky that there, sometimes they come, the answers come even as you're writing the question. So that helps me get everything going. So then when I sit down to write, I've got that to work with.
That's really interesting. I'm going to try that for sure. Cause I've heard people talk about that, you know, with your intentions, if you write them down in a notebook, they're going to happen. I've never tried that with writing. I think that's fantastic. So you sort of do like a loose global outline, kind of know all the major pieces, and then do more detailed outlines chapter by chapter as you go along.
Yes. Four chapters at a time.
Yeah.
I make a grid on a page of a notebook. And that helps me also think about how I want to do more cliffhanger chapter endings. I once interviewed Laura Lippman, and she called it the distant shore approach, where she follows the same thing, where she knows where she's going, but it's like this lake or river you're swimming across. You don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. Loch Ness monsters, like, in the middle of that lake. But I don't think I totally appreciated for a few years into writing fiction how that part was so magical, because you're writing and you don't have everything planned out. And all of a sudden this idea comes to you, like you discover something about a character you didn't know that your brain just decides to tell you. And to me, that is the truly fun, incredible part of writing. And that's why I wouldn't want to plot it out so completely in advance. Are you a plotter?
I am a plotter. And I kind of do the same thing, you know, do the global outline. So I know where I'm going. I have my roadmap or my swimming line across the lake. I know where I'm going. But yeah, I think you need some room for like creativity and play inside the constraints you set yourself. So I think that works really well.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to be doing a program for fiction writers, thriller writers. And one of the things I am encouraging anyone who's, I mean, it's for beginning authors. In the beginning, don't be a pantser, you know, be a plotter. That there are people like Lisa Unger, who's a really wonderful friend of mine, who just lets her characters take her wherever they go. And she is not a plotter. But I think when you're first starting out, it's so much better to do a certain amount of plotting, or you'll get yourself boxed into a corner.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and I have a little bit more questions about your plot specifically to this book. So in between Two Strangers, Skylar unravels this mystery often by uncovering memories, which are overshadowed by this traumatic event. What are the challenges when you're writing clues that way versus chasing them down on the street? Was that difficult? I'd love to hear more about how you did that.
Well, it was different because in my mystery series, it's about a girl named Bailey Weggins, who's a true crime reporter. And so she's the almost like a gumshoe, you know, she's out there, she's pestering people, she's asking stupid questions, sometimes purposely, she's just sticking her nose where it shouldn't be. But with Skylar, she needs to figure out why the guy left her this money. And there aren't that many avenues for her to go down. She does approach the mother. She approaches the lawyer who set this thing up, who set it up so she would be assigned this trust. And they tell her they don't know. So there aren't too many ways she can do it by pounding the pavements or doing a Google search. So she's left with really trying to understand is there anything that night they spent together that would have left a clue that he was going to do this? And I did do some research into memories. And in her case, it's not so much recovered memory, because it's more because her sister ended up dying that same weekend. She doesn't like to think about the one night stand because it reminds her of her sister. So she just really tries to peel back some layers. And one of the things she does, because she's a collage artist, she ends up deciding to create a collage where she goes to the hotel they stayed at online, and she prints out some pictures from it. She writes words about this game they played, Two Truths and a Lie. She starts making a collage of all these elements. And sometimes things like songs can trigger a memory that you forgot about. So for her, because she's a visual person, she's hoping this will trigger it. And she does begin to have little snippets, flashbacks of things he said, things they talked about. But ultimately, it's something someone says about the collage that gets her thinking and ultimately comes to the truth. Because really, digging deep into your, trying to find memories that you haven't thought of for a long time is challenging. And she's not going to have some huge breakthrough. Oh my God, I remember that night. But she remembers snippets. But and ultimately, doing the collage does lead her to the discovery.
Yeah, I really like it. Was just so interesting because, I mean, it's not like it's never been done before, but the way that she just uncovered it, I was like, this is great because it's very internal. You know, a lot of the tension is internal because she just can't deal with going back to that memory because of the trauma that happened to her. And I thought the visual was just fantastic. Just as we were talking, it reminded me like of Ray Bradbury said that, you know, when he wrote stories, he used to go back to the where those events had occurred, childhood places, stand there, and those events would kind of come up. And I really like that it escalated that way for her, having to get closer to that memory and closer to that trauma that she'd been avoiding. So it was a lot of fun for me to read that.
Yeah, in the beginning, she doesn't do that. She is trying to ask some questions. And I originally had her, because this is the Kate White way, making little notes. And then I realized, well, no, she's an artist. She would maybe try to do it visually. Mm-hmm. And it was fun for me to do a little bit about the art world too. Most of my protagonists, I've tried to have their professions be close to something I would know, like the true crime writer. I had somebody who wrote celebrity biography. This is the first time I had it far afield from me. And yet I love art and I'm a huge art viewer, gallery, gallery person, just traveling around galleries on weekends and museums. And when we travel, my poor husband, every museum.
That's awesome. So I want to ask a little bit more about the crimes and murders in your book. How do you go about doing your research to make it realistic, to make those kind of things happen? What type of research do you do when you're writing?
I do research, and I'm sure I make mistakes, and readers are very forgiving. I think they probably feel like, I know as I'm a reader and I'm reading stuff, I sometimes think, it sounds like she spoke to the police, but if she didn't, I don't care. I'm reading along. I like it. Years ago, I met this fabulous woman for my very first book that I was researching. A cop in New York told me about her, and her name is Barbara Butcher, and she worked in the ME's office for many years in New York, and she was at over 5,000 death scenes. Not all of them were murders, but... Yeah. Go in the place of the medical examiner and try to determine cause of death. She and I became really good friends, and I encouraged her to write a book, and her book is coming out in June, and it's really great. It's a memoir. Wow. And it's called What the Dead Know, and it's about her life as a death scene investigator, but also a lot about her life personally, coming to terms with being gay, coming to terms with, being an alcoholic. So it's very, very moving, but woven in is all this great stuff about being an investigator. She helps me with every single book, everything. I can just call her up saying, if somebody was slashed from behind, you know, what would it look like? And when I was at Cosmos, I remember one time I was in a meeting and she had sent me some color photographs of someone's neck being slashed and then bleeding out. And I opened a folder in this big meeting with corporate, and there's guy with like a gaping hole in his neck. And then up with police, I've met a few police people over time who police personnel who I go back to again and again. But one of the things lately, I needed to talk to somebody for this book in New York City. And I was just told, no, we don't do that. We don't have the time. But I'm sure if it was Michael Conley calling up her Lee Child, they would, but little old me, no. So what over time I got to know different detectives and police personnel in other locations. And certain things generally apply overall. They're very helpful to me. And one of my best pals in New York was a neighbor who is a top defense lawyer. And I just take her out to expensive lunches every few months, and then I can call her about everything. But I would advise anybody, it really does help if you get to know people. And most people are very giving. And the great thing about doing research is that you often come up with plot twists, because someone will tell you something that you think you're just trying to make sure you're doing your getting your facts correct. And then they'll sometimes say something that you realize that is a great little thing I'm going to include as a turning point in the book.
Oh, I like that. Is that, do you have other ways that you come up with plot twists, or is the expert suggestion like kind of the main one, or how do you write fantastic plot twists, or is it just your brain kind of working on it?
Yeah, a lot of authors say, oh, I thought of it in my sleep, or I did, you know, I don't know how I did it. But I think if you reverse engineer that, you see that a lot of that I think is sometimes even playing with like polar opposites. You know, the husband is almost always the person who kills the wife. But what if he isn't? It's like that Agatha Christie mystery. No, spoiler alert here. What is it? The Roger Ackroyd or whatever his name is. You know, she must have said to herself one day, what if the protagonist writing about how they're trying to figure out who the killer is actually the killer? So sometimes it's just good to play that game. Start with something and go through it and just do the opposite too. And more, because today, I don't know how you feel. I'd love your thought on this. Some twists are so bizarre. I feel like it's jumping the shark, like that old line from TV where you're just like, oh no, please. I don't believe it. I read a book lately where the woman had not just one serial killer in her life, she had two, and it just drains the credibility. So I more and more I try to have the characters drive the twist because of their personalities. I think, what is there about this person? What would they do in this moment? Get back to the character, not just let my mind think of a plot twist, but what would the character do? So then it sounds more authentic to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. And when you get those plot twists and you're like, wait, what? Why?
Have you felt that too?
Yeah, there have been books that I've read and I'm like, I don't understand how this is related to the rest of the book.
Or it's just so outrageous.
Out there. And it kind of feels like Deus Ex Machina or something. And you're like, what? Yeah. Where did this person, or you haven't seen that character before? And it's just like,
it is. It's all Deus Ex Machina. I just read the new Jane Harper Exiles, which is a police procedural. And I really loved it. To me, she's a great writer. I didn't love her last book as much as the others, but this one was so good. And the twist is just so authentic and believable. And you probably could have thought of it yourself. There's certain things in there that you would lead you to possibly have this assumption. Just so good clues that all make sense. And this happening made sense too. And you're just like, thank you, Jane. I don't know you, Jane. I wish I did, but thank you.
Thank you, Jane, if you're listening. Give us a call. Kate wants to talk to you.
I want to be your best friend.
Yeah, you never know. That's awesome. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the food in your novels. Like, you have very detailed use of food. And I know you previously edited a Mystery Writers of America cookbook. Is this something that just happens naturally, or what role does food play in your novels?
It is so funny you say that, because when I was asked to do the Mystery Writers of America cookbook, the guy who called me up from the committee and asked me to do it said that somebody on the committee, Frankie Bailey, who is a professor of, I think, law and also maybe covers forensics at State University of New York at Albany, I think is where she was. She said, oh, we should get Kate White to do it. Not only was she an editor-in-chief, but she's got all this food in her books. And it hadn't even occurred to me. But I guess, you know, I love to eat. I do like to cook. I'm not a great cook, but I will follow recipes. And I like to think, Christine, I set a cute table, which I used to try to make up for the fact that I'm not a great cook. But I realize I can't not include it. It's just part of who I am. Now, a couple of books ago, I started trying to do it a little less because I was doing it so much. And my editor, who I've had now for about 5 or 6 books, she's really great. One day she said to me, well, when did they eat? And I said, oh, well, I'm trying to play down, you know, the eating so much. She goes, well, I'm getting hungry. So that was back writing about food.
Yeah, I loved it. I noticed it in Between Two Strangers as well. I was like, oh, that dish sounds really good. I'm like, I'm going to look that up. Maybe I'll eat that. I can find the recipe.
Yeah. Oh. So Skylar, she lives alone and she's a little curmudgeon-y. And so she's not much in terms of the food stuff. But in other books, if they've been in a certain setting, like in the book I wrote a couple of books ago, The Fiancé, she's staying, the main character is staying with her in-laws and they have this big estate and they're every meal is prepared by someone, but it's all sort of in this great setting, done kind of family style, casual. So that was fun for me because I got to mention a lot of dishes.
That's awesome. You also do Zooms with book clubs. What's that like? Book clubs can be wild. Like, do you have any good stories about doing Zoom book clubs?
The thing about Zoom book clubs is that one of the things I found is that people seem a little tongue-tied. I don't know if this is anything that rings a bell for you, but what happens is that the person who's running it asks a couple of questions and then nobody asks a question. And it, to me, sometimes it kind of feels a little flat towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
But the funniest thing that ever happened during the pandemic, where people were just really experimenting with Zoom, this one woman said to me, I've done something a little different. I'm using stadium seating. And we're all going to be in seats. And that way it'll just be a little bit better. And then you won't have to wonder who the people you don't see on screen are. But the problem is it was so weird. Everybody was in the seat and they had this little body and then their head was on it. And my head was the same size as everybody else's. So when I was speaking, I couldn't even tell it was me because all the heads were the same size. It was so disconcerting. So I hope no one ever does that again.
Oh my goodness.
What do you think of book clubs? Do you think it's an effective way for authors to do it? I find talking at a library so much more effective.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know. Like I've been in a couple of book clubs and I'm like, sometimes we read the books, mostly we just drink the wine. So it's like, yeah. And then they ask you questions and you're like, but yeah, I find them often they're a bit more social. Whereas I think people coming to the library are actually really interested in the books and the craft and that type of thing.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it that with a library, everyone has come because they're interested in you, yeah. Even if they haven't read the last book, or they're interested in becoming an author. Mm-hmm. With book clubs, there's a chance half the people haven't read it or are interested in you. So then you're fighting that kind of inertia that comes from that.
Yeah. So as we're wrapping up, I just have one final question that we ask everyone. If you could offer one piece of advice to new and aspiring writers, what would it be?
I think if I could just say one piece of advice is something that helped me a lot. When I first started trying to write, I didn't write. I couldn't write. I was a procrastinator. And every panel I went to, there would be some pompous author that said, if you're not writing, it means you don't want to be a writer. But I really think for me, it came down to I hadn't found the right genre. I didn't know my writer's cocktail, when I could write, what was the best time. And I didn't know that for me, because I was a procrastinator, the best thing for me was not to bite off more than I could chew, but just start by writing 15 minutes a day. Get a timer, set it for 15 minutes. Don't bite off more than you can chew, because just because you're not writing regularly, I believe, doesn't mean you don't want to be a writer.
Absolutely. And I think you call that slice the salami. Did I see that somewhere?
Yeah, slice the salami. Yeah, that's what a time management guy called it. Just write in smaller segments and build up from there. Because to say I'm going to write for the whole day is just too much for even me today.
This episode is brought to you by MasterWriter. MasterWriter is a powerful collection of writing tools and references assembled in one easy-to-use program. Included are word families, phrases, synonyms, rhymes, definitions, figures of speech, pop culture, a searchable Bible of intensifiers, and a unique collection of intense descriptive words. Why struggle to find the right word when you can have all the possibilities in an instant? While a computer can't compete with the mind and imagination of a writer, the mind can't compete with the word choices that MasterWriter will give you in an instant. When the two work together, great things happen. Check it out today at masterwriter.com.
Okay, so this was just such a fun book, so much like a wish fulfillment. And I'm just curious, have you ever received anything unexpected that has affected your life in any way? I'd love to hear about it. JP is nodding. Go, JP.
Such as a review from Bigless Dickless.
Unexpected bills.
You know what? Yeah, I don't want to get back on that, but I saw Amal's tweet in response, who was one of the writers, and she was just like, I don't understand what is happening, but I'm very grateful to Big List Dickless.
But thank you for my new house.
Wild.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So the inheritance story is kind of funny. Nowhere near millions at all. But I did have a great uncle who I inherited something from, and I very unexpected, out of left field. I was just graduating college, and I made some poor mistakes about investing in college, and this was like random moment of like divinity, and I was very pleased with it because I would have been screwed. But yeah, I've had that happen before.
I don't think I've ever actually been in somebody's will. I guess that speaks to my character. Nobody actually puts me in. it makes me think this should be a trend. You know, this isn't what happened in the book, but like maybe we should all just start picking like some random person like out of the phone book or off the internet and just slap them in our will just for the hell of it.
Just, yeah,
I like.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, why not? You know, yeah.
I like that's kind of like a pay it forward kind of scenario. That's going to make a great book, JD. Thanks. I've already started outlining that.
I don't think my children would appreciate that. Hey, Mom, Dad, you know, how come I'm not in your will? Well, I thought I'd just give all the money to
Ryan. He didn't say exclude your children. He just said add this person.
Well, I mean, in Kate's book, it's a fantastic hook because this woman sleeps with this guy one time 12 years ago and ends up inheriting billions of dollars. You know, first of all, you know, she must be phenomenal in the bedroom, for that to happen. There's something going on, but like she dragged, you know, like the whole book, you're trying to figure out, you know, what is the why? And she keeps it going, you know, cause that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. No,
I can't even get people to review my books on Amazon.
Well, I have a fun story like that. When I was a rookie cop, we got assigned to go to a funeral. And we're like, well, what's the circumstances? There was an older gentleman. He's probably in his late 70s, early 80s. Worked in a factory all his life. Passed away. Well, before he passed away, he met a younger gal. he was like in his mid 70s, whatever it was, and she was in her mid 20s. And he wound up dumping his wife of like 40 years or whatever like that for the younger gal. And he had two or three kids. And he saved all of his money all of his life. He was a saver, and he had a substantial amount of cash and a house. And he wrote everybody out of the will except for this young gal that he met like 6 months before he died. So there's all kinds of threats about dismembering the body at the funeral. They said they were going to cut him up. So I had the head. I'm standing at attention at the head of the casket, and another cop is at the foot of the casket, and everyone's going by to say their final goodbyes. And I'm expecting somebody's going to come out with a butcher knife and just start going to town. And I'm like, well, the person's already dead. They're not really killing him, you know? And I'm just like, oh my God. I'm like, please let nothing like that happen. So it went off without a hitch, but it was very odd. And there was a lot of hard feelings there. There was a lot of angry
way to turn the whole thing dark, Patrick.
Yeah. Well, that's my life, Kevin. It's very dark.
I think that, yeah, the older man, younger woman, like that's a fairly common, you know, thing. I mean, that happens pretty often. I think what the reason was unique for Kate's story is, you know, this was, you know, she met this guy in a bar, and like they just hooked up the one time. That right. was it. No contact afterwards. That's what makes it intriguing, because you know, you start looking around, you know, like beyond the obvious, trying to figure out why. And again, yeah. She does a great job of you know, filtering that information out there and keeping the twist coming.
It's like the opposite of Fatal Attraction. Like, yeah. If you were to invert Fatal Attraction, this is the story.
So yeah, she really likes to include her interests, like food and art. I don't know. Do you include stuff like that in your novels? Like highly specific interests in cool ways? What have you done with that?
I mean, in her book, I literally got hungry like reading that book, because she goes there, you know, and she's very good at describing the food. You have to be very careful with it, though. I've got a mentoring student that I'm working with right now. If I had to guess, maybe 20 to 30 different things take place over dinner. You know, like, you know, information is revealed, like, you know, they go yeah. to this place and they have dinner. They go here and they eat lunch. But like they're all over meals, and the conversations between the characters are all happening while they're eating. You have to change it up. You know, like you can maybe have one conversation that takes place over dinner. You know, one thought that maybe comes to the character while they're in the shower. That was the other thing in this particular book. She's got this character showering, you know, like constantly through the book, which I guess, you know, it's obviously a real thing, but you know, you can't play out the whole story that way. So it's like, mm-hmm. I think it's important to try and piece those kind of things out, the mundane stuff. You know, you can mention it once, maybe twice, but that's it. You know, change up your locations too. I mean, I see a lot of people, you know, where the book, you know, like the character will run off, do something, come back to, you know, point A, and then they go off and do something else, come back to point A. And like that to me slows the story down. You know, if you can get them to go someplace different every single time, keep it fresh, you know, that keeps the pacing up.
They go to a different restaurant, a yeah. second cafe.
Something. They go inside instead of the drive-through. Something.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There is something to be said for looking at if you have too many of the same scene types, like we call that the mm-hmm. chatting over coffee scene or eating dinner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can give that information a different way, like pairing up with walking through somewhere new while you're seeing things. But yeah, too many chatting over coffee scenes can get a little tired.
Yeah, a lot of authors sure. do that with meetings too, you know, like certain yeah. types of book, like Tom Clancy yeah. type stories, you know, they'll have 50 meetings throughout that book. Yeah. And you know, if you break it down, you know, just look at the information that's actually exchanged in that meeting, you know, that it could just as easily happen here or there or this place or that place. It doesn't have to be around a conference table. Yeah. And I think it's important to change that up.
I do admit to there being a lot of coffee shop / cafes in my books, and a lot of conference rooms because of the FBI angle. So something to watch out for. But yeah. I feel like I don't overdo it, but I'll let readers be the judge.
Well, I did include a chicken fettuccine Alfredo recipe in one of my books. And it did impress the heck out of a date.
I don't doubt that.
And I put that in there.
Good. So we can learn how to make your chicken fettuccine Alfredo.
Yes, and it's not even close to being healthy, just so you know.
Doesn't need to.
Not even close.
Perfect for a murder mystery.
Yes. But with the price of butter.
You know, you're right. Yeah. I'm crying as I'm putting those sticks of butter in there. No.
Somewhere around the 12th stick of butter, I thought, perhaps I'm overdoing it.
Perhaps my mortgage won't be paid.
Yeah, exactly.
It's cereal tomorrow, kids.
Yeah. So the other thing I thought that was interesting is, you know, we were talking about weather, like Kate writes better when it's hot and it's sunny. Does that affect your writing at all? Have you ever noticed? I never really thought about that, but I'm like, yeah, I'm way more miserable when it's gray and cold.
And you live in Canada, so it's and cold and miserable like the there all the time.
The, the official national weather of Canada is gray and cold.
Exactly.
It feels like the heat, like where did she say she was?
She's in Uruguay.
Yeah, yeah. Like that just seems muggy and stuffy. Like you would want to just lay around and do nothing. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know that I could get anything done there. I'm very horrible with it. Like I've got an air conditioner in my office, one of those split units. It's always 72 degrees in here. It doesn't matter if it's -5 outside or 85 or 105. You know, so I don't change that up. I can tell you, like when we first moved into the, you know, that we had that duplex in Pittsburgh, there was no air conditioning in there. The temperature would fluctuate anywhere from like 50 degrees in the morning to like 80 degrees at night. And like, there were certain times of the day where I couldn't write. You know, it's definitely a thing.
Yeah. If I didn't write when it was hot and humid outside, I would literally never write in Texas. So I have air conditioning going at all times. Texas. Yeah, I mean, it can get bad. You know, you don't do a lot. There's not a lot of that, like sitting in a cafe outside writing in this area. Better in Austin than in Houston.
The 10 showers. So do all your characters take 10 showers because they're in?
All my characters, they're perpetually wet.
Right before dinner, they take a shower.
Yeah.
I wouldn't blame them.
They're like gorging on a.
They have dinner in the shower, Alfredo. Kevin? Is that what's going on?
No.
I do have someone gave me one of those cup holders for the shower, so you can put your beer in the hang it from the glass of your shower.
Is that a real problem for you, Kevin?
Kevin, really?
I use it for coffee. I'm not a beer guy, so I put my coffee in there. So
I'm never 6 feet away from a firearm in my house, and you got to have a beer with it 6 feet.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not a same beer thing guy. For me, man. Yeah, you're not a beer guy because you live somewhere warm and sunny. So if you come up to the cold and gray, I'll make you a beer guy. So come on.
That's what every Canadian tells me. I that would be an interesting experiment to see if that panned out. You and Mark Lefebvre both want to get me addicted to beer, but I'm a straight up coffee guy with bourbon.
We can do it together and come out with Mark and I and a skeleton and we'll sit around and have a beer. So, you know, the other thing that Kate was talking about that I hadn't really thought about was book clubs because, you know, they do tend to be kind of more social. So I'm wondering, like, what experiences have you had with book clubs? Do you find libraries are better? Do you find you engage readers more somewhere else? What do you think about that?
Personally, I love book clubs. I forget who another author turned me on to them. So I basically started including book club questions in every one of my books at the back. If you go to my website, there's a webpage specific to book clubs where you can download those questions. And I find that just by having that out there available on the web, book clubs find it. Then they, you know, and they buy your books in mass. You know, they're buying 10, 20, 50 copies, you know, all in one shot when the club decides they want to read it. And now with Zoom, like it's crazy easy. You know, like they basically just book an appointment with me. We set up a Zoom call and I spend 30 minutes or an hour, you know, talking to these people and, you know, that's it. I prefer that over the libraries and even the bookstore talks only because there's travel involved. It's, you know, for one or two events a day, if you're lucky, or if you do it with one of the publishers, you know, they load you in a car and they just take you from one to the next, to the next, to the next, which is, it's tiring. But you can't fit in as many of them as you can if you're doing it over Zoom. But they do talk up your book, you know, like if you know, you've got the club buying your book and reading it. And if they like it, each of those people run out and they tell 3 to 10 other people about it and it keeps it going.
You've mentioned that strategy before. I really think that's a brilliant thing, and I keep meaning to do that. And that's an example of something I think AI would be really handy for. It's to just, you know, they have to come up with a way for us to be able to feed an entire book into one of these things, though. So far, that's not a thing.
Now, JD, do you put these questions just at the end of your book or at the end of every chapter?
No, it's at the end of the book.
How many questions about?
20 to 25.
Okay.
Yeah, because the questions themselves a lot of times have spoilers in them. You know, so you have to be careful where you put those out. you know, if you do have spoilers, make sure you have something at the very top to let people know there's a spoiler, you know, somewhere down below.
When you found out that the murderer was.
Exactly.
That's a great idea.
You know, something else she mentioned is to keep the plot twisty, but realistic. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important too, because I've noticed, you know, lately that books tend to fall on, you know, one end of the spectrum or the other. Either the twist is just something you've seen 5 million times and you can see it coming, or it's something that's just so outlandish, it doesn't even make sense for that particular book. And you know, this person had it like on a post-it note on their computer monitor, like, oh, I get to write that twist in another 22 pages. Like, they were excited about it. They thought it was a good idea. But it's just so far out of left field. It just doesn't make sense. So like they have to be realistic.
Yeah. So is there anything else you think that writers can do wrong with their plot twists other than not making them realistic?
I think you have to, it has to play out. You know, like I've seen some good twists too, where the twist comes along and I'm like, that was solid, but like it never actually, you know, feeds, you know, fills part of the story. Like it's a twist that was put in for it just to have the sake of having a twist. But they don't play it out far enough, or they don't actually answer it or justify having it there. So it's gotta be fulfilling at the same time.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got TJ Newman coming back. She's a New York Times bestseller of Fallen. She was on once before, and you may want to check out that interview if you haven't heard it yet. She was a former flight attendant. She essentially wrote Fallen while standing at the back of the plane while working, you know, on notepads, because they're not allowed to use phones. And then she had to go home and transcribe it. She sold this book for multiple seven-figure deals. She got 7 figures in the U.S., another 7 figures overseas, and a 7-figure film deal. So she's back with her sophomore effort. It's called Drowning, and it releases May 30th. So she's going to tell us all about it.
All right. Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Do you want to write crime stories that are accurate and believable, but lack firsthand experience in law enforcement? Join CopCamp, the Cops and Writers Interactive Conference, and experience what real-life police officers and detectives do through hands-on activities this June 1st through the 4th at the Fox Valley Police Academy in Appleton, Wisconsin. Limited class size of 30 to 40 students ensures an immersive, interactive experience. Attend firearm simulations, drive a squad car, solve mock crime scenes, and use real CSI tools, and more. Register now at premeditatedfiction.com/copcamp2023 and take your crime writing to the next level.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.